welcome to the WDW Review, and I'm your host, Chris Smalek, and I'm joined by a guest co-host today. Welcome back, Chris Smith. Chris, how you doing, buddy?
Chris, I'm doing great, man. It's been too long since we talked, but I'm excited to get back on with you.
You know, I always look forward to having you on. I write down constant notes, and like I'll try to assign them in my mind, like, okay, who could cover this really well? And I've got a Chris Smith page here that was like, I'm afraid to even show you what that is, because you'd be like, no way am I going to tackle all that. So,
Well, I know what it is. You know from past experience that you just throw out a topic, and man, I just start talking and you have to pull me back in. I think that's probably what it is.
I love it. You and I at least love talking, so we can talk about anything. Just give us an attraction. We're good for an hour. So, but I've got you on with a special purpose today, because we're going to air this show just before Halloween. So we talked about the Haunted Mansion before, and that was our spooky, it wasn't even a Halloween special, just our Haunted Mansion special. So we're going to go down the line and pull the other headline spooky attraction out. So let's talk today about the Tower of Terror. You ready for this, buddy?
Yes, let's do it, ma'am.
All right. So little backstory. So the tower, I'm a drop tower fan. At any park that I can go to, I'm terrified of them, but I love them. So I have this love-hate relationship with them. So when the tower, when I first, cripes, years ago, it's terrifying. You wait in the queue, which is completely immersive. It's the most immersive queue on Walt Disney World property. The haunting music, the well-placed, you know, Spanish moss, the trees that look like they're just about ready to fall over, the collapsing architecture. It's amazing. It might be my top attraction. If it's not number one, it's 1B, right next to the pirates. So I couldn't be more excited about this, because we all feel that haunting magic presence when we're in the line, and I'm just excited as heck to learn more about it today. So,
oh yeah, man, me too. And it's, you know me, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find an attraction that I don't enjoy, but you know, I think there are a handful of attractions that are really, you know, what I call Imagineering masterpieces. You know, those attractions that really kind of combine everything from, you know, immersive queue, great storytelling, phenomenal attraction experience, you know, have it all. And Tower of Terror is absolutely in that short list of what I call Imagineering masterpieces.
It's a small list. You're exactly right. Because
it is.
In addition to everything you mentioned, innovative ride vehicle, and even right now, and the tower's getting up there, still it blows your mind that, wait a minute, again, it actually comes out of the elevator and it enters down this hallway. So even still now, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get into that. You know, so much to talk about, you know, from the history and the queue and the ride experience, but you're right. You know, most people don't realize how amazingly complicated that ride vehicle system is for the Tower of Terror. And you're right. You know, it's been in place since 94, and that technology, you know, it's complicated now. Back then, it was kind of groundbreaking, and still works, right? Still works for the storytelling experience. And again, yeah, I'm a huge fan, obviously.
I'd argue that when you talk about icons for parks, I know they had, you know, the Eiffel Tower there, you know, and whatnot. But I would argue that Spaceship Earth may be number one. But again, this might be number one, because anywhere you go on property that's within several miles, if you're on an upper deck view and you look out, you pull that thing out and you point, you're like, that's the tower right there. There's no mistaking it. It looks like, and nothing else in Central Florida.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, you know, it's like, when does that storytelling process begin for the Tower of Terror? And really, you know, maybe Expedition Everest, right? With the mountain landscape there for Animal Kingdom, but you see that thing, and especially, you know, you can see it even before you enter the park in a lot of places, but when you kind of take that right turn onto Sunset Boulevard, see it in the distance, and palm trees lining Sunset Boulevard leading to it, you know, it's just, man, it just pulls you in immediately, and kind of that excitement and that worry starts, you know, at that point, you know, even long before you enter the actual queue. The minute you see that large structure at the end of Sunset, you know, you're kind of pulled in from the beginning.
You're so right. And, you know, it's not the unicorn drop tower. It's the Tower of Terror. And it looks haunted. Are you kidding me? So I've got a list of questions. And first question I'd like to know is, it's the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. And can you give us a little bit on how the Twilight Zone got commingled with the Tower of Terror? Was it simply a marketing effort, or did they develop the storyline? Or tell me how that kind of worked together.
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. And it kind of goes back to, you know, the opening day for Disney's Hollywood Studios back in 1989, right? And so, you know, the park then is much different than it is today, right? It was by design a half-day park. You had a handful of attractions, you know, I think five actually on opening day, and then you had an actual working movie production studio. And so even though Disney had the plans for it to be an opening day a half day park, from the beginning, fans just flooded, you know, to the park. You know, lines for the few attractions were long, just an overwhelming hit. And so immediately, you know, they start thinking about expansion plans and kind of, what do we do? You know, what do we do, you know, to help add capacity? Well, you know, Sunset Boulevard was added. You had so many fun potential ideas, whether it was a Roger Rabbit's Hollywood, you know, a Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers area, you know, a Mel Brooks Young Frankenstein area, a hotel Mel Brooks with a scary component. And for whatever reason, they landed on this intellectual property tie-in of the Twilight Zone, which, you know, I love the Twilight Zone television series, right? I've been a sucker for it, you know, for as long as I can remember. And I think with that kind of spooky aura that it added, they felt it gave it kind of a good IP tie-in, and then eventually landed on, you know, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. And I'm sure as we'll get to, tons of fun references to that television series hidden throughout, you know, the queue and the actual attraction experience for the Tower of.
Do you still check the wing of the plane, Chris, for a man on the wing of the plane now when you fly somewhere as a reference?
Oh man, I tell you, it's really, you know, you had that original series back in the 50s, and then you had the remake as well. But I tell people, if you've never seen, especially that original 1950s television series, you'll see reruns on Sci-Fi, and you can find them other places as well. Give them a watch, you know, give one of them a chance, because, man, just tremendous storytelling in so many of those television episodes. I believe, if I'm not incorrect, there were 156 episodes. And Imagineers watched every single one in the creative process, you know, before construction began on the Tower of Terror. And I think that's fantastic, because I think kind of that character and that sense of storytelling and that sense of just really, you know, dread and that surprise fear factor that the show had, I think you see that replicated in the attraction itself.
Yeah, so maybe just a little aside here. So the Twilight Zone, so each story was self-contained. There wasn't a bingeable like character from episode 1 to 150. Every story was individual. So you got the full ensemble in 30 minutes. And you're right. You know what? It was, at that time, it may have been considered, you know, modern in terms of makeup and special effects, but it was the writing. Every episode had to pull you in, opening, middle, conclusion, and they had to thrill you with every episode. So the writing had to be great, because honestly, it was on the air for forever. You know, so it had to be spectacular. So yeah, fabulous. And I remember clear visions. I'm in my mid-40s of laying in the front room or laying in the dining room and watching my dad watch the Twilight Zone and hearing the doo-dee-doo-dee-doo. You know, I have clear visions of that and thinking, I shouldn't be watching this. I shouldn't be watching this. I'm not going to go to sleep well tonight. I shouldn't be watching this. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, man, that's a great point. And even people who aren't familiar maybe with the television series itself, or haven't kind of, you know, sat down and watched full episodes, they know that theme music, mm-hmm. and they know Rod Sterling. They know that guy, you know, the guy, yes. who kind of gives that introduction, that voice. And you're right, man, to have that many episodes where they are all standalone stories, new characters, new storylines, and you start it and you finish it within 30 minutes. Man, that's good stuff, good storytelling as a part of that show.
Okay, so we're tied into a really well-themed and well-written, IP. So it's not even so much necessarily the drop. The drop, it's a drop tower, but we're talking about the ride unit itself. But it starts so much earlier than that. And like you said, even when you've walked down Sunset Boulevard and you have to walk through the gate and you're in the gardens and you hear the music, I mean, this was not by accident. They designed these long queues to give you these hidden and these obscured shots of the tower, and you hear the scream. So let's talk about the outside for a while. What were they going for, and what was the intent with the queue and the gardens out there?
Yeah, so it kind of goes to the story of the Hollywood Tower Hotel. Right. And so when this thing first opened, it was, kind of glitz and glamour, that golden era of Hollywood. And, disasters, we know from the attraction itself, disaster strikes in 1939 on Halloween night. Well, when that happens, the hotel immediately closes. Right. So you go from this gorgeous, five-star magnificent hotel for the show business elite to now an abandoned, scary type structure. Well, how do you do that, right? Well, I think what they did is they hit the nail on the head with theming of what would happen if you just walked away from this massive structure and these opulent grounds. What would it look like years later when people are invited back in, right? And you see that, right? So you kind of walk through those gates, you see warning signs, you kind of look at the pathways, and you've got signs that point to the, to a bowling green and to tennis courts. But if you look closer, kind of the roots of the trees have kind of now, intruded upon the walkways, and what was once, great kind of, intricate stonework is now crumbling. Mm-hmm. Right. And, as you wind around, you get to this, abandoned reflecting pool, right? That's long since dried out. One of the things that I think that is the greatest about, especially that outdoor queue area, is the music. Right? So that's, that 1930s era music that, if you were to listen to it without, the visuals that surround you, would have a much different feel, right? Would have a different, kind of more of an upbeat feel. But when you combine that music with kind of these abandoned grounds, it creates this spookiness, right? That's really hard to kind of describe unless you're there seeing it and hearing it together. And then certainly as you get closer and you're kind of looking upon this massive structure, kind of that dread starts to slowly creep in up to the point where you actually duck inside the building and enter into this lobby that kind of takes that storytelling to a whole new level at that point. Absolutely. And one more quick point, kind of before we get inside, those cast members, right? Their dress and their mannerisms, much in the same way as the Haunted Mansion, we talked about in a previous episode, those cast members help to kind of further that story as well, right? That something just isn't quite right, and we shouldn't be here, as we're strolling through this pathway.
Exactly. And they sell, I don't know if you've, Chris, I don't know if your wife is asked to buy this, but I know mine has looked at it with a discerning eye in the Cherry Tree Lane gift shop, the dress shop at the marketplace. They sell the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, like full ensemble. It's the dress and the hat and whatnot. And yeah, that's nice. It's also $200 plus. So let's not look at that one. But yeah.
Well, what's funny is Chris is like, you know, if she were to ask me for something that costs $200 that you know something completely, you know, usable around the house, I'd be like, you know, I don't know. That's but if she were to show me that, sign me up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm all in.
There you go. All right. So we've gone from the gardens and we just enter the lobby, and I've probably taken a picture every time, and it's not one picture. It's probably 7 or 8 pictures that I take of this, just the lobby entrance, and I'll kind of wait for the guests to move out so I get the unobstructed view myself of the giant bird and you know, the cobwebs and whatnot. But take us to the lobby here. What do we see?
Yeah, and Chris, you know, man, I'm telling you, if we're talking about, let's talk about attraction cues and even attraction scenes in of themselves. So, you know, what are the best areas? Man, I think this lobby scene has to be up there, because mm-hmm. if you're talking about immersing you into a story, if you're talking about transporting you to a particular time and place that's just filled with detail, man, this lobby, it just knocks it out of the park, mm-hmm. right? So you walk in, and immediately, like you said, you see this, it's both, you know, grand and imposing, but lonely, right? You know, cobwebs cover everything. You have, you know, as you mentioned, directly in front of you, this large owl sculpture that's covered in cobwebs, you know, dead roses, you know, surrounding it. You know, to your left is that famous Mahjong table, right? So this board game that Imagineers brought in, believe it or not, there are such things, champion Mahjong players, to begin a game and then stop them, you know, in the middle of the game and make them leave. So literally, if people were to have disappeared, that's what that board would have looked like. You know, just ahead of that, you see another table. And this is one of my favorite kind of details of any Disney attraction. You see a champagne bucket and champagne and gloves with a ring there on the gloves. And one of the champagne glasses has lipstick. What that is, it was a sign of a proposal, you know, the night that everyone disappeared. And both, you know, both individuals disappeared. The ring is still there. The champagne's still there. The people just aren't, right? And I think that is just fantastic. To your right, you have that concierge desk, right? And so much good detail there. You know, just great. You know, this expensive alligator skin luggage that has been left. You know, a AAA 13 diamond award, right? 13, which is great. You'll see a poster for the Anthony Fremont Orchestra playing at the Tip Top Club at the top of the tower. That is kind of the first of many Twilight Zone references, because Anthony Fremont is the name of a character from an episode called, you know, It's a Good Life. And so just everywhere you look, so much fun detail. And it's really, you know, especially for people who are going through the attraction for the first time, you know, your head is kind of looking in all different directions, because there's 360 degrees of storytelling going around. You kind of approach, you know, kind of those, you know, kind of take a turn and head towards the elevators. You see this mail slot, right? This all these mail slots where guests would have gotten their mail there. A newspaper from October 31st, 1939 sits there as well. I mean, it's just so much fun detail there to be seen. And if you, one more thing, if you look up, right, I think one of the most gorgeous pieces of any attraction is the ceiling in that lobby, right? It's really a work of art, that kind of a mosaic of gold and bronze up above you, that again, if you kind of, you see what it is now, but you think about what it looked like back when the hotel was in its heyday, man, it just really just a fantastic area.
Even Disney and experts can't go into the lobby and fully appreciate, because there's so much detail. The smallest things, even from the lettering on the boards that have fallen off and actually spell words, and I'll let you talk about that. There's just too much to almost grasp. So every time you go through, if you just picked off just an area to look at, you'd find something new every time. One of the other things that I'm always amazed at is attractions and Disney's use of lighting, and not necessarily even the ambient shade, or the color of the lighting, but the actual fixtures themselves. If it's not in the Pirates, if it's not at the magic carpets outside, but here, like, it is a complete ace. For every light fixture they installed here, you would believe it's 100 years old. It's 100 years old, and at one point, it was the pinnacle of lighting perfection in Hollywood. And now it just looks like it should after the aging process occurred. And I'm always amazed at how they get the lights right every time on every attraction. And this is like this is the Magna Carta. This is the pinnacle of lighting and light fixtures for an attraction in a Disney, you know, attraction.
Man, that's a great point. I think you could probably do, you know, an article, a story on kind of, you know, the best Disney light fixtures. But you're right. You know, the hotel is that. And my personal favorite one is this large ornate sconce that's actually, you know, as you're leaving the exterior of the hotel and walking into that lobby, you know, that's posted there just on the outside, you know, huge, ornate, magnificent, and now kind of abandoned and covered in cobwebs. And that transitions into the lobby as well too, right? And if you think about it, that story is, you know, at the time this hotel, you know, on October 31st, 1939, this hotel was at the very peak of luxury, right? The very peak of convenience. And again, you know, what you would expected for, you know, kind of your Hollywood stars, the time to expect as a part of their, you know, relaxing experience. And it's there right down to the light fixtures. Fantastic stuff.
Okay. So we're in the lobby, and even still right now, I know we're glossing over details, but we're going to go into the first room, and they've kind of funneled a few guests off to the side, and we're going to officially start the process of seeing the pre-show. So as we funnel into, is there a name for this room? Is it the library, or is it just the pre-show gather? What was it actually intended for, Chris?
I think it's technically a library or a parlor, right? So this area that, again, right? I mean, it's, you know, talked about kind of the lobby and the storytelling that's done there. This library area does the same thing, right? You walk in, and certainly you see kind of, you know, all these different bookshelves and books and different fun things that go on. Well, this is really where you start seeing some of those Twilight Zone television series details, right? So before a television comes on, before you kind of get the story of the attraction, you know, lots of fun things to see. And I'll just kind of give you a couple of my absolute favorites. Mm-hmm. One, high atop one of the shelves, on the very top of the bookshelves, is a little, you know, it looks like a little toy almost with a devil's head on the top, right? And that's actually it's called a Mystic Seer, and it's from one of my personal favorite Twilight Zone episodes that actually starred William Shatner of Star Trek fame. And I believe the episode's called Nick of Time. What happens is the character played by Shatner and his significant other stop at a diner, you know, for a meal. And there's this little toy where you put in a coin and ask a question, and it gives you a response, you know, yes or no, that kind of, you know, tells you your future. Well, after a couple of fun questions, it becomes abundantly clear that this thing really is telling the future, right? And it's almost one of those things where they become paralyzed by fear, wanting to ask another question. And finally, you know, the significant other convinces him, listen, we need to walk away from this. We need to go away. And you agree to do that. And, you know, after much convincing, well, as they walk out, another desperate couple rushes in, and clearly they've been there before. And, you know, they're haggard and worried and scared and beaten down. And because they could not walk away from the machine, they come back with more coins. They're trapped. They're trapped by that fear. But again, that Mystic Seer with, you know, the little devil's head device you see there at the top of one of those shelves,
I wrote it down for sure. I haven't seen it, but I'm going to be definitely YouTubing it for sure at this point.
Yes, absolutely. And I have, this is something that I've seen, right? You know, it's not just, you know, it's there. It is absolutely there. So two more I'll give you.
Yes.
One are a pair of glasses that sit atop a book. And those glasses reference another old episode, Time Enough at Last, I think is the name of the episode, but it starred Burgess Meredith, right? And so in that episode, he is a bookworm, and it drives him crazy. All he wants to do is read books, but he always gets interrupted by people. He never, you know, he can never get time alone to actually read books. And thanks to a nuclear war, he's the last surviving person and finally has all the time in the world to read these books. But as fate would have it, he drops and breaks his only pair of reading glasses.
Oh,
right. Man. So, you know, so again, he's got, you know, he finally gets what he wants, but now his glasses are broken and can't read those. But just one more, and this is my absolute favorite Twilight Zone reference in the entire attraction. You'll see a book that kind of sits to the side and has this strange text that you can't make out. You know, it looks like a foreign language there. But a handwritten note on top of the book says "to serve man," right? And so this is a reference to a Twilight Zone episode called that same name, "To Serve Man." And in that episode, you know, these tall 9-foot aliens visit Earth on apparently humanitarian purposes, right? They're there to help us and to do good things. And they invite, you know, a group of humans to come back to their planet, an apparent, you know, utopian paradise. Well, they leave behind a book in this strange text. And so a cryptographer, you know, kind of goes through and deciphers the title of the book, which is called "To Serve Man." And so you would think, great, that, you know, they are here to help us. They are taking us back, right? Well, you know, for good intent. Well, as he deciphers the book further, it turns out to be a cookbook, right? "To Serve Man," right? I mean, how fantastic is that? So you have that book there with that note translated "To Serve Man." And again, details like that all through the library, which pay homage to that television series, and I think are just fantastic.
And I feel like a newbie because, you know, I've seen the details and I appreciate looking at them because in my mind's eye, they match what a parlor or what a library should look like. And you don't realize the kind of depth and level of detailing, even though we should because we're used to seeing it with Imagineers at this point. So we've all funneled in, though. So we've got 20 or so people. And this is, of course, pre-COVID. We got 20 or so people, and we funneled in. And then what takes place at this point?
Yeah, so at that point, a black and white television comes on, and you see kind of this Rod Sterling character from the television series The Twilight Zone, and he kind of gives the overview. And what's fun is, you know, they combined actual footage of him from the 1950s television series, and also combined that with, you know, kind of new footage from impersonator to kind of make it, you know, as legitimate as possible. Well, he kind of explains to us this story, right, of what happened. Right. So October 31st, 1939, Halloween night, you know, the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, this couple with I believe the story is, you know, kind of this daughter who's really the movie star. So you've got the three of them, an overworked nanny and a bellhop just trying to carry all the luggage. And what happens is lightning strikes and the couple disappears. Everyone disappears. And, you know, the two wings that are in the front of the hotel kind of, you know, blow off, and just like that, disaster. Right. And so that night, October 31st, the hotel officially closes. But now, you know, a group of us have been welcomed back to kind of tour the grounds and take a peek behind the scenes. And as we'll eventually get to a different type of elevator.
Okay. So my 6-year-old was hanging in there through the gardens, and the anxiety was probably a 3 or 4 out of 10. And it got raised in the lobby to about a 5. And the library pushed it to about a 6 or 7, okay? Because at this point, I mean, it's dark and it's scary.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the door opens up, and we now funnel into the boiler room. And this is pretty much where she lost it. And I could not get her on the attraction at this point. And I think it may have scarred her for life because she would not go on the tower in Paris and she would not go on the tower in California. But everything sets you up. And now you've gone from the parlor. Now you're in the basement, essentially. And you're in the boiler room with these massive boiler equipment and these pieces of machinery. And it's dark. And there's these red dim lights and green dim lights, and it's just illuminating the path, and it's a cue getting you ready to position to actually board the elevator or your ride vehicle at this point. And I don't know how much detail there is in this room outside of it just conveys the ominous feel for this tower that, like, man, this has never been a good idea to be in the basement of a giant haunted hotel in our life. This is not a good idea. So is there any additional detail I'm missing here, Chris?
Yeah. You know, what's funny is you know, you've kind of gone through you kind of these three phases we've talked about where you have just overwhelming detail, right? So the exterior of the building itself, that exterior queue area, the lobby, the library, you know, so much visually to see that I think people kind of pass through that boiler room and kind of just, you know, you really don't notice anything. But, you know, again, tons of detail there, right? You know, you boilers and furnaces and iron and just this, you know, this dark, cold area. You know, a couple of fun things are, you know, kind of the doors where you would, you know, put coal in these furnaces are in the shape of demon faces, right? So if you look close enough, you can kind of see those, and even some kind of fire seems to be kind of still simmering in there. But even as you kind of wind close to the elevator, the service elevators themselves, if you look to the side, you'll see old tools and equipment, right? Where people would have worked on these furnaces and this equipment, right? And so everything's industrial, everything is iron, everything is steel, and everything is weathered from the abandoned time, right? So it's not like you have as much detail as you did in these other areas, but still, if the story is you're going from, you know, this library, this parlor to kind of the bowels of the hotel itself, that's exactly what you would see. What the Imagineers have done there is exactly what you would see in terms of furnaces, boilers, tools, cast iron pipes, you know, maybe some fire still flickering. All ties in still very well with the story of this abandoned hotel.
And as soon as you approach the cast member who's going to assign you to which row you're in at this point, you kind of know there's no way out. There's a chicken exit if you want to take it at this point because frankly, I've been there with my six-year-old at that point, so I know what the chicken exit is. But really, you're pretty much on the spot at that point. You're going for a ride from this point forward.
Yeah, what's funny is I think, you know, so it's like when does your fear hit its absolute peak? You know, as a part of this attraction. I mean, certainly we'll get to the actual drops, but I think that kind of standing there, you know, waiting for the hotel for the service elevator doors to open, I think that's where fear may be at its all time high, right? Mm-hmm. Because you know from kind of, you know, seeing the hotel from the outside, you know that a drop is going to happen, but you've kind of, you know, been lulled into a sense of security seeing these different fun things along the way, but now, you know, it's the literal jumping off point, right? Yeah. There's no turning back at that point when you're about to board the actual elevator.
It got real really quickly on you, didn't it?
It did. I've ridden Tower of Terror, you know, just like you have, Chris. I mean, just probably just countless times. Man, I still get the butterflies.
Yeah.
You know, as you're standing there about, you know, waiting on the doors to open, still get those butterflies and that anticipation of what's about to come.
All right. So the doors open and you're assigned in a it's almost a theater style seat where it's elevated in the back and it goes down to the front. So you get a good unobstructed view and you'll understand why in a little bit. And the cast member has a speech that they deliver and it's about 30 seconds and it's appropriately frightening and mysterious in its own right. You're seatbelted in and you're off. So if you've not been on the tower, you're not sure what's going to happen. And I hate to spoil this for you, but if you're listening today, we're going to go through everything and it starts to rise. So what is the first thing we see when the elevator rises?
Yeah. So, you know, you and I had to kind of talk about this a little bit before we got on the air. The ride vehicles for Tower of Terror are extremely complicated, right? Just you know, it's not just your plain elevator shaft, because if you think about it, what has happened is you've traveled through the show building and now you're actually at the back of that show building, right? You kind of know, if you think about it, that the drops happen at the front, right? But right now we're at the back. Mm-hmm. Right? And so as we get in, the elevator goes up. Just one quick fun detail I want to share: there's actually an inspection certificate inside the hotel if you look, and you'll see that it was actually inspected on the last day that the hotel was in operation, on October 31st. And the inspector, the name of that inspector is called Cadwalder. All right. And what's interesting is that's a reference to a character, again, from the Twilight Zone television series. Wow. Where Cadwalder was actually the devil. Right. So if you kind of do that math, the devil is who last inspected the service elevator before the hotel shut down, right?
Oh, so, man, again, that's priceless, Chris. I never noticed that. So, okay.
Yeah.
I'm making a note right there. I have to go and find that as well, too.
Okay. Right. Very fun detail. But anyway, so, all right, so you go up and the elevator door's open. So you're looking ahead and you have a couple of different things that go on. You see kind of a window in the distance, and thanks to a Pepper's ghost effect that I think we're all pretty familiar with from the Haunted Mansion, you see these five individuals that disappeared back on Halloween night years ago. You know, you've got the husband, the wife, the daughter, the bellman, and the nanny, and they're all waving and inviting you, you know, to join them. As they disappear, you know, you see a star field in the background, lightning strikes, the window shatters. And it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of fun things that are going on in that scene. And for me, I'm going to make a Splash Mountain analogy, right? So on Splash Mountain, one of the things that's fun about that attraction is you get some fun drops before you get to the big drop. Right. And even though, you know, wait a minute, I'm nowhere near where I know that big drop happens, there's still that anticipation. Mm-hmm. Right. So for me, even though I know we've only gone up a little bit of space, you know, maybe one story or so, and I know that the drop takes place at the front of the building, you still don't know, like, you know, am I about to drop now? Is there more to this story? You know, is it going to happen right now, or is something else going to come? So kind of building that anticipation by seeing the family, seeing the window, seeing the star field. And, you know, again, it doesn't happen yet. The doors close and we go up a little bit further.
Gotcha. So I was doing a little bit of research on the Pepper's ghost and how they create that and the lighting they have here, and simple and so very effective. So very effective. My favorite part of this whole thing is where the window just seems to kind of hover there and kind of twist on you. And it's so ingenious and so simple. So God love them for having the foresight to create that. So we're past that scene. What's the next scene we face?
So then we go up another few levels, and this is where kind of that ride vehicle technology really kind of shows that it's not just an elevator shaft, right? So the doors open and your elevator cart actually move forward, right? So in the back, you've gone up, you know, just like any other elevator would do, but now you're moving forward. So horizontally, you know, across, you know, essentially moving from the back of the hotel to the front of the hotel. And they call this the fifth dimension scene. So some kind of crazy, quirky things you see, you know, a clock spinning out of control, an eyeball, you know, kind of floating in the distance, electrical, you know, kind of, you know, you see electricity kind of flowing all throughout the landscape, and you're kind of moving forward. And one of my favorite things, Chris, is, you know, what's happening is you're moving again from the back to the front to be locked in to where the actual, you know, drops of the attraction will happen. Well, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, right as you get to the front, you hear this voice singing, you know, it's raining, it's pouring. And there's something about kind of the tone of that voice when you hear it that just sends a chill up my spine every single time. And, you know, and all this stuff happens pretty darn quickly, right? So you don't have a lot of time as you're kind of moving forward, but you feel that elevator shaft eventually kind of lock into position. And so what's happened is this vehicle, you know, you've moved up in the back, moved horizontally to the front of the hotel, and now you're locking in again for what's going to be, you know, that hair-raising finale.
So if you live on the West Coast, or if you're listening in Europe and you're thinking, wait a minute, that's not what mine does, it's not a disservice because it's proprietary to Florida. In the other parks, or at least in Paris and in California, it stays in the same elevator shaft the entirety of the trip. And you may rise and see scenes and drop and rise and see scenes and drop. But here it moves out like a Wonka Vader, like Willy Wonka. It goes up and down and left and right and all around. It takes you out. So this is completely unique. The first time you go on it, you're completely unprepared because you think you're on the attraction. From the moment you sit down, you think that elevator shaft is where you're going to be. And then all of a sudden it goes forward on you and it locks you in position. So, okay, at this point, it has a number of things that the elevator can do at this point. Does the window to the world open up, or does it have to achieve a certain point before it opens up, Chris?
Yeah, so this is what really makes the Tower of Terror such a unique attraction, right? So just even above and beyond kind of the detail and the theming and the story that you get above and beyond what kind of other drop style attractions have, right? You know, even without all that stuff in a normal drop attraction, it takes you up and it drops you down maybe a couple of times, right? And, you know, a really fun experience. Well, here, and this has changed, you know, the Tower of Terror has actually changed a lot since opening day. So like originally you got one kind of 13 story drop and then they added another drop. Well, now today, thanks to a computer program that's randomized, you never know what series of drops you're going to get, right? You can either go up to begin, you can drop to begin, and there's just no way to predict it. You can get four drops, you can get three, you can get different heights of those drops. It's all completely randomized. And I think that, man, that's just fantastic, right? Because even for guys like us that have ridden it so many times, we can't tell a newbie who's coming in, all right, here's what's going to happen, because we have no idea, yeah. Right? Now, you do have to your point, Chris, you got to go up some to kind of get that visual, that opening that looks out onto the park, right? You got to go up a little bit to get that. But again, you can't predict what's going to happen, but what I can guarantee is going to happen is your blood's going to pump, you're going to get some high drops, some fast drops. Yes. Correct. And a couple of fun things, you know, while we're talking about it. So, you know, while the Tower of Terror was being constructed, they added these massive motors to the top of the structure, right? That would harness these elevator shafts at the front. And by virtue of doing that, the speed at which those elevator ride vehicles drop is faster than gravity, because it's not just open air dropping. They are literally being pulled down by these motors, right? And so, again, you're kind of falling faster than gravity. And I can just tell you from experience, Chris, I feel that.
Yeah.
when I'm on the attraction. And what's fun too is, you know, because you know, you're looking out onto the park, right, as a part of these drops, the ride experience is completely different during the day versus riding the Tower of Terror at night. Right. I mean, you get two completely different experiences, I think, because when you're looking out over that park in the day, completely different if you're looking out at night. But it is, listen, you know, we all kind of joke about, you know, kind of, you know, quote unquote thrill attractions by Disney standards. Right. So, you know, Big Thunder Mountain Railroad, which I love, you know, it's not kind of, you know, in the world's top 10 most thrilling, you know, coasters, but Tower of Terror, you know, by any standard, Disney or otherwise, you're going to get some thrill and you're going to get some excitement in that drop finale.
Chris, much like everything else in my life, I know just a little bit about everything, which makes me dangerous enough to make a lot of mistakes. So correct me if I'm wrong right here. But my mind was literally blown today as I was researching it. And I realized, and I hope this is correct, the company that constructed the elevator is not any different than the company that constructs most elevators, and it's the Otis Elevator Company. And I was like, wait a minute, hang on, that's the same company I was just on yesterday at the hospital with my mom's doctor's appointment that was manufactured by Otis Elevator Company. And they have three different braking systems pending some kind of disaster. You know, the first standard brake, then they have an emergency brake on the gear or on the counterweight, and then they have potentially, if it does, there's a variety of over-engineered safety measures on this, so your danger's never even put in question. But
right,
my mind was blown that it was made by the Otis Elevator Company, and like, you wouldn't think of them as a theme park construction company, but this makes sense. It's a massive elevator. So
that's right. And there's some funny stories out there just in terms of, you know, I mean, you know, Disney is famous for kind of doing things in-house, right? And there's kind of a track record of going outside the Disney circle, bringing in contractors and not working out, and Disney just kind of doing it themselves. But here, you know, elevators are, I mean, you know, that's just not like building, you know, kind of a box, right? I mean, that's a specialty industry. And there's some funny stories about, you know, kind of the Otis people. I mean, listen, they make elevators, but no, guys, we need this one to drop, right? We need this one to fall, right? And yeah. So just kind of, you know, different people and companies getting out of their comfort zone, using the expertise that they have but also having to kind of go a different route as well is really cool. Because, you know, Otis, I mean, let's be honest, right? The elevator you were on, you know, you're talking, listen, you know, they don't want that thing to fall, right? You know, but this one, right? We need for that bad boy to fall and be pulled down at a high rate of speed.
Exactly. So I was amazed at the counterweight mechanism, which means the motors simply lift just the weight of the people as the counterweight's equivalent to the weight of the elevator. All good and dandy, but you're right. The third mechanism is the pulley on the bottom attached to it. We need this to be pulled down so aggressively and so violently that it falls, like you said, faster than the speed of gravity. And so, yeah, just the brain power to go into that, it's amazing. So you could get three drops. You could get six drops. You can get a shot all the way to the top. You can, you know, come crashing down to the bottom. But what I learned was the elevator exits about midway, because the back of the building's only about halfway up the shaft. And it's at that point, that's where the random cycle takes place. So when you exit that shaft, how far up are you, Chris? Do you know, is it 5 stories, 6 stories, 7 stories? Do you know where the exact exit point would be?
I don't know exactly, but you're right. You know, it's off center. You know, when kind of take a step back, you know, when Disney was building this thing, you know, they wanted height, right? You wanted it to be tall, but you know, you've got that 200 feet tall, you know, stop post that if you're at 200 feet, you have to have kind of a blinking red light up there for FAA regulations. So to kind of get around that a little bit, they constructed a hill upon which to build the Tower of Terror, so that, you know, even though it's 199 feet tall, when you're kind of looking at it from sunset, it looks even taller because you've kind of elevated the ground. But I'm not quite sure where you actually exit at, because kind of you've got that offset in terms of where the construction actually began.
Gotcha. It still just amazes that you could get anything, and it's a mystery from every ride through. So you've finished now, and you've gone up and down several times, and you've survived. Is there any more detail? Is there anything else before the vehicle comes to a stop and lets you disembark?
Not before you disembark, but man, there's some fun stuff as you actually. So before you actually step off. So, you know, when your ride vehicle stops, it kind of turns, right? And it turns to a doors that has a B on it, right? Because, you know, according to the story, you're in the basement now, right? When those doors open, that B becomes, you know, the unlucky number 13, which again, you know, a lot of these things, Chris, and I think it's just a perfect example of things you and I have talked about in the past of, you know, you can go to Walt Disney World and you can enjoy all these attractions knowing little to nothing about all these different fun secrets, right? And Disney could still make a lot of money by not adding that detail. But man, they add all these fun things that 95% of people don't notice. And that's what makes Disney different, right? It's the B basement that becomes a 13. It's all these Twilight Zone television references that most people don't even see. It's that level of storytelling that takes Disney, I think, to the next level.
It's awesome. So we exit, we're through the gift shop, and of course we've bought stuff because, well, we have to buy stuff at this point. I've never been here, but I've always wondered, as you stand on the outside of the gift shop and you look back above your head, back towards the tower, you see almost an area where it would be a balcony outdoor area. It almost looks like a gathering place, or it could be a banquet facility. Is there anything up there that can be seen by public, or is it a private event, or is it not even used, Chris, at that point?
I think that's really not even a used area. That just kind of, you see it from a visual standpoint, but I don't think they actually use it for anything. But I will tell you, if you're standing out there and you look up at the tower, so you're kind of getting a look at the tower itself from the side. Mm-hmm. There's a window there, right? There's a window that, depending upon, you know, the time of day you're there, will be off or on, and you might even see some movement, right? Somebody up behind that window. That I think is, again, another super fun detail. And a couple of other things, you know, not to make your show, you know, 2 hours long, but you know, that path when you leave the ride vehicle, there's a ton of fun. There's a lost and found area that has some more fun props from the Twilight Zone television series. You know, the area, it's kind of a cheap gag, but one that I think is fantastic is when you kind of go to the counter, you know, where you have the picture area, right? So let's go see the picture of us on the actual attraction. There's a sign that says, you know, picture if you will. And that is one of those kind of key Rod Sterling catchphrases from the Twilight Zone television series that is obviously very appropriate for an area where you would buy pictures. And as you kind of wind through, you'll see three different banquet halls, one of which are ballrooms, excuse me. If you look, there's a menu that's still attached that shows you what was going to be served on Halloween night. And it's one of these, you know, 10 course, you know, opulent, you know, great meals, you know, with three different choices of main courses and soups and salads and all these fun things. But again, you know, another fun detail that shows you, that ties in, that, listen, this was a hotel for the upper crust of society, and one that, you know, again, would be the type of people that would be having these massive multi-course opulent meals.
Chris, I just wrote it down because I don't know if I've ever seen that. So I'm definitely going to have something new to look for. So anyways, that was an awesome look. That ride never fails to get my, like I was showing you earlier, it never fails to get my heart pumping as fast as it does. And the moment you disembark, you have that feeling of, yes, I got to do it again really fast. You know, and then you go outside and you realize the line's now 75 minutes and whatnot, and you may rethink your plan. But yeah, always a showstopper and a headliner. And even when we ask people in our group and our listeners all the time, it's always finishes 1, 2, or 3 as far as your favorite attractions at Walt Disney World.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, if somebody who's never visited Walt Disney World, and you know, they come and ask you, okay, you know, give me an attraction that's a great example of, hey, this is Disney. Right. This is what sets Walt Disney World apart from every other theme park in the world. Right. And I think there are a handful of attractions that you can point to that this is what happens when Disney hits it out of the park. This is what happens when Disney is at its absolute best. And Tower of Terror is that, right? I mean, it literally has everything. It's got an amazing show building. It's got a fantastic story, incredibly immersive queue. Just a heart pumping, but not just a thrill experience, right? A fun, immersive storytelling experience as well. And right down to the exit path, as we were just talking about, even fun details for you to see there. Just an absolute iconic attraction. One that I know that a lot of people, you know, there's plenty of folks, including people in my family, that, you know, they don't want to experience a thrill attraction, right? They're not, you know, it's just not their cup of tea. And number one, I encourage them to, all right, try to take that leap of faith because it is a fun experience. But even if you don't want to ride the attraction, man, go through the queue, yeah. Right? Go through and see this store that we've talked about. Kind of take in those details. Walk through that lobby. Walk through, you know, the library and see all this fun stuff. Because, you know, for a Disney geek like me, Chris, those immersive queues like Tower of Terror, they really are kind of an attraction in of themselves.
And I did mention earlier, it is valid and true. If you get up to the front before you board, if you tell the cast member, I don't want to ride, they will escort you through and around, and you will not have to ride. It's called a chicken exit, but I mean, so to speak, it's what it is.
Of course, yeah. But you know, Disney's not going to force you, right, to get on that elevator as much as we tried to make it out to be that way. But who knows, too, right, Chris? I mean, you may get to that point, and having seen that great story, you know, from the walk down Sunset through the other areas of the hotel, who knows, you may have gotten that extra courage that you need to actually take that step onto the ride vehicle and give it a shot.
Now, so having you on today, you know, you and I are friends, but in addition to that, I'm also a fan. So, I mean, I've got two books here of you. You know, I've got the Backstories and Magical Secrets of Walt Disney World, and that deals with a lot of Magic Kingdom information. And I've got the Walt Disney World That Never Was, Stories Behind the Amazing Imagineering Dreams That Never Come True. And you can find these both on Amazon, correct, Chris? That's where I found mine.
Yep, that is correct.
But if you wanted to find more information on the tower, I couldn't find that right now. So I was hoping you'd have some information on that. So where can I find information on the tower? Because I know that we've touched only on a little bit about this.
Right. So, yeah. And thanks for asking that, Chris. I've got a project that I've been working on for a good year and a half that is kind of a labor of love that will finally be published. I just made the final cuts. And so it's just getting through the last couple of hoops that'll be published in the next 30 days. It's called A Magical Half Century. And what that is, it's just a bunch of fun stories that kind of celebrate Walt Disney World's first 50 years. And one of those is, you know, from my backstory series, Chris, man, when I hit an attraction, brother, I go deep, right? I hit those details. And Tower of Terror is one of those that I felt like I was trying to pick topics of what really symbolizes, you know, what are kind of some of the peaks of these first 50 years. And for me, Tower of Terror was one of those. So I do a deep dive there, hit some other fun topics like, You know, one of the hot topics now are Disney's use of intellectual properties, right? You know, why do we have to force these IPs into the parks, whether it's Star Wars or Toy Story Land, or Marvel or other things? And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to take a look at Walt Disney World from 1971 to today. I'm going to do a historical analysis and look at how has Disney used IPs throughout the years. Has it changed? Are we moving in a certain direction? Have it changed from park to park? And it absolutely has, right? I mean, it's kind of this story behind the IPs and Disney's use of that. I do a look at that, and just a lot of other fun stories. If you wanted to know the Legend of Sleepy Hollow's connection to Walt Disney World, I hit that. Fun alcohol references from the parks that Disney uses. So it was kind of my love letter to Walt Disney World after 50 years. And certainly Tower of Terror is a big part of that book.
Well, I'm going to be adding it for sure. And I mentioned earlier, is Amazon, is it the best way to find your books, Chris? Is that the best spot for them?
Yes, you can definitely find me on Amazon. I actually have a website, chrissmithbooks.com. If you want to learn more about me, you know, in addition to my books, I'm there. And then I'm on Twitter also at csmithdisney. If you like I know you do, Chris, if you like these fun details that we're talking about, if you like old construction photos and old historical photos of Disney,
yes,
I always put that stuff up so people can find me at any of those different places.
Chris, I'll be honest. You know what? We have a Twitter account. I have personal, and we have for the show. And a lot of the stuff I pass by, whenever I see your posts, I always find something cool to look through. And I'll be honest, I've stolen more than one picture to keep as my desktop phone saver because you put something really cool out there. I said, I got to take that picture. So hit save picture. Good. We got it. Nope.
Well, I'll tell you what, Chris, what's funny is listen, man, you and I both love Disney, obviously. And I've written a bunch of books and have even more in process. And it's the same thing with your show, right? I mean, what I think my books and your podcast do is it shows us, man, we're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, we're not just a couple of dorks who are buyers. You know, so many people love Disney. So many people love these details, love these stories, love to hear about different things about the Disney company. And listen, you know, I'm an attorney by day, right? If you're looking to get rich writing Disney books, brother, you're in the wrong business, right? I don't do it for profit. I do it because I genuinely love it. And I write books that I would want to read, and I write it because I think that other Disney people like us would get a kick out of it. And that's why I do it. And so far it's just gotten a very humbling and great response. And hey man, we're not alone. There are plenty of men and women and children out there like us who love the Disney parks and love hearing and reading about it.
Outstanding. So again, did I get this right? ChrisSmithBooks.com. Is that correct, Chris?
And that is correct.
And on Amazon, you'll find him as Christopher E. Smith, because there are multiple Chris Smiths. So I've learned today. So find Christopher E. Smith. And again, I've got the Walt Disney World That Never Was and the Backstories and Magical Secrets of Walt Disney World in my possession. So again, I appreciate you spending a little time with us today. Always exciting and interesting to learn about the Tower of Terror. So again, Chris is also on Twitter. So if you have any questions for Chris, find him on Twitter. And if you're struggling to find him, contact me and I could help put you in contact with Chris. And you can find me in our Facebook group, which is EDCOT, EDCOT, or on the WW Review on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, pretty much everywhere. Reach out to me and, you know, we'll get you guys, if you have a question or something, I can put you in contact with Chris. So anyways, We hope we provided a little bit of excitement, a little bit of laughter, a little bit of spookiness to your Halloween listening for the week. And we'd like to thank you and wish you a spooky day.
You got it. Have a great Halloween, folks.
This elevator travels directly to the Twilight Zone.